Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a talk episode where we're going to answer listener questions.
How do you spell talk?
T-A-L-Q.
It's all good. I'll figure it out eventually.
How are we doing?
Very good.
And really quickly, we do need to play a game of what are we drinking?
Oh, yes.
So I actually, this is a rare one. I think twice, including today, of 230 something tries, I have been the one that have brewed coffee. And so it probably suffers because I'm the one that brewed it. But what do you think we're drinking?
Well, I kind of know a little bit already.
You do.
It's flavored.
I want to say it's like a medium flavored coffee. And the flavoring is maybe like a caramel, nuttish something.
Okay.
I'll say it is a city roast, which is between a medium and a dark, leaning slightly dark. And it's here's the thing. If I smell it, it has like a cherry smell. But when I taste it, and listener, take no offense, I just taste chemicals.
Ooh, it does smell cherry.
Yeah, something fruity. But I just taste acrid.
Okay, what
chemical.
Is it,
Josh?
I'm not drinking it, so I have no idea.
What are you drinking?
I'm thinking about Andy's septum and whether or not he's capable of smelling things accurately.
Okay, so
wait a second. Awesome. Wait a second.
It is a Sweetheart Swirl from Herman's Boy Inc., Herman's Boy Coffee Ranch in Rockford, Michigan.
Nice.
Oh, they have good coffee. I've had their coffee before.
Flavored.
Flavored.
Rich vanilla, sweet cherry.
Oh, okay.
And toasted hazelnut. And I do think it's meant to be a medium.
Josh, you apologize to my septum right now.
Your septum does not have conscience. It does not need to be.
That's true.
Apologize to. But a gift from Reverend Jonathan Fuller.
Thank you, Pastor Fuller.
Oh, thanks, Pastor Fuller.
And I would like to comment that some of our listeners,
it's not necessary,
would like to tell me that friendship would make coffee taste better. Jonathan is one of my best friends, college roommate. We spent years together in college and seminary.
You guys were legendary in Greek. It was just
something like that. But I would, in this case, and this is purely anecdotal reasoning, my friendship to Jonathan does not make this taste better.
Okay.
It's okay. It's an okay coffee. I like it, but it grew on me.
Yeah. I think it needs some cream. So I really think coffees like this need a cream to cut through the chemical stuff, and then maybe you catch the hints of the flavoring more.
Also, I would say if Andy had brewed this, it would probably have tasted better. I'm not the best brewer, so
yeah, you can't out-brew a bad bean. So
yeah,
I had my coffee wizard wand down there,
books and business.
All right, on to books and business. Quick. So I'm gonna go first, and it's gonna be super quick. I've made it about 80% through The Brothers Karamazov. My copy is about 900 pages, and I'm into the 700s. And I'm very excited about that because it took a while to get here. But
Charlie,
hoping to finish it this week.
I just want to commend you on your commitment.
Mm. Yeah.
Well done.
Well,
way to keep going.
If you go back in the podcast and you remember like how I said I'm going to try to like have a main book each month, and The Brothers Karamazov was the main book for January.
Oh, gotcha.
And
okay.
It is now February. I'm pretty convinced that's a common experience with people that try to read this. That
you picked
them
beast to start the year off.
Yeah, it had been sitting there for so long. It needed to happen. And also on the side, when I get bored of Brothers Karamazov, I'm reading Tale of Two Cities. So, you know, it's been some long nights. Anyway, no, I'm just presented with no quote or really any comment, but it does get considerably more compelling, I would say, in the 50 to 60% range once the strings start kind of tightening and you see how the plot and the characters develop in distinct ways. So anyway, but yeah, it's been good.
So my book is The Destruction of Christianity, What It Is, Why It's Destructive, and How to Respond by Alisa Childers and Tim Barnett. I don't know if I said those names correctly. Carl Truman writes the foreword. This is basically about deconstructing and people who are deconstructing their faith. I thought the book was helpful. It's very accessible. It's very readable. And it's not too many pages, like 250 or so. It's divided essentially into four parts. One of the things that surprised me, this is not a conversation that I'm really into. I don't follow a lot of this, but there's a lot of people who have deconstructed, and most of this is taking place on social media, which is why I don't know a lot about it. But on TikTok and Instagram, they have all of these feeds, and a lot of it seems to be stemming from popular evangelicalism, particularly the music, the CCM music industry. So I didn't know who Alisa
Childers.
Thank you.
She was Childers. She was in the band Zoe Girl.
Yes.
She was very popular as a singer. And then she also wrote another book, which I'll talk about when you're done with this one.
Yes. And so
I believe we've talked about before.
Yeah, I think I highlighted it. And then I watched a debate or an interview debate between her and the Gunger lady.
I have wondered for so long about that tattoo that you have. Zoe Girl. That's what it is.
Dude, Josh is drinking an energy drink. He needs to drink an energy drink every single week we record.
It's right next to his Muppet Baby tattoo, correct?
And on today's talk episode, we will talk about tattoos.
We got to keep moving. We're behind the times, but this is wonderful.
So she even says, I should be standing hand in hand with the mass exodus of ex-evangelicals flocking to social media to share their deconversion stories and placing the hashtag blah, blah. Anyway, I should be one of them, she says, because she used to be a Christian pop star. And I didn't know, like, the DC Talk guy, Cayman's Call guy, all of these CCM bands.
So the DC Talk guy, really quick. So Kevin Max Smith, yes. He was one of the three DC Talk guys. He deconstructed about like 8 years ago or 10 years ago. And yeah, he now believes in the universal Christ. It's some nonsense religion. And so then you have Toby Mac, who's kind of stayed the course. He lost his son like 5 years ago. His son like died suddenly. It was really tragic. And he had a pretty good testimony of continuing with the Lord. But the big controversy that just happened like a week ago is the last remaining member, who is the head of the Newsboys right now, Michael Tate, has suddenly dropped out. Completely. He just like resigned. And there's rumors that he's got some sort of closet sin issue, maybe with homosexuality. Uh-huh. And so it is sad. Like I have like maybe two Christian bands. I don't listen to that kind of music anymore, but there's only two looking back who are still walking the walk. Almost all of them have diverted.
I think it says something just about the CCM movement as well. So something that our listeners might want to just have a little bit of discernment over. So in this book, I mean, I read the whole book and there's a lot of things I could talk about it. I learned several things. The first section is basically about deconstructing and people who are, and then the definition, which is a big issue. People are like deconstructing their faith in a positive way because they're figuring it out. And they're basically saying that's a bad use of the word. You can't say you're deconstructing your faith, trying to figure out what you really believe. I'm going to read a little bit from page 67. I think this kind of creates there's like a tension when you're working with somebody who's deconstructing, particularly if you love the individual, which hopefully you would, but particularly when it's like a family member. So on page 67, they create a contrast between a burial and a battle. And really both of those things are taking place, particularly when a loved one is deconstructing. There are two responses, broadly speaking, to this issue. In many ways, we feel like we are writing with both tears in our eyes and a sword in our hand. At times, having a loved one in deconstruction is like going to a burial. Tears flow and words fail. Then in the next paragraph, at other times, however, responding to deconstruction is like going into battle. The same scriptures that command us to have mercy on those who doubt also tell us to hold firm to the trustworthy word as taught and rebuke those who contradict it. The Bible is clear about God's attitude toward those who draw others into sin and unbelief. And this is what deconstructors are seeking to do. They don't just say, oh, this is me, you do you, I do me. No, they're trying to actually pull others out of the faith and into unbelief. So it's like you're mourning their abandonment of the faith, but at the same time, you have a sword in your other hand and you're defending the faith. So I thought that was actually a really helpful perspective on how one handles deconstructors. The final thing I just want to highlight, I really wanted to bring out, you know, why are so many people deconstructing? But this took me all the way to the end of the book, chapter 10, The Deconstructor, to find an answer. And they eventually do get there, where they say sin can play a role in deconstruction in two ways on page 184. And they say that first, deconstruction is often a reaction to sin. And then second, deconstruction can be motivated by sin. And as we've talked about on the podcast before, why do people abandon the faith? Because there isn't evidences. Okay, because they can't prove that God exists or whatever. No, it's because they want to sin. And this book got there, but it took towards the end of the book to get to that point. And I think that's an important part of the conversation. So there's a lot more that I could say about this book, but I thought it was a very good book. I'm going to put it as a 6 on the Thinkling's Goodness Scale. If you have a loved one who is deconstructing, then this could be a really good book for you. Or if you want just a little bit more information in the movement about it, then I would recommend it. It is very accessible. It's not a very technical book.
Well, the book that I started this week is a biography of Frederick Douglass called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. It's written by David Blight, who is the professor of American history at Yale University, or at least he was in 2018 when this book was published. I teach Frederick Douglass's autobiography in American literature. If you know anything about Douglass, he has 3 editions of his autobiography. The first one is called Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, and that was published in 1845. And then in 1855, he comes out with My Bondage and Freedom, which is another edition of his autobiography that he adds some details to, and it's a little bit longer. And then in 1881, I believe, he comes out with a final edition of his autobiography, and that's The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass.
Well, which one do you assign?
Well, the one that I typically teach is the first one, The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, because it's the shortest one, and it's the one that's kind of closest to his slavery experience. And it just has a lot of verve and some really eloquent and descriptive passages about slavery itself. The other ones are more interesting because they add more details. When he's writing in 1845, he has to be very careful about what he says, what he publishes, because he can still be tracked down and returned to slavery. But in any case, afterwards, so the reason I'm reading this biography is because I'm interested in his life as an orator. He spends 50 years after he escapes slavery. He escaped slavery in 1838, and in 1840, 1841, he begins speaking, and he is joined with William Lloyd Garrison and some other abolitionists, and he begins speaking, and for 50 years, he's an orator. And that's the part of his life that I don't know as much about. But I was reading this, and this is interesting to me. So one of the things that Douglass used to commonly recite is something that he called the slaveholder's sermon. And so this was a crowd favorite too. They would ask him in the North to recite this. And so here's just a paragraph about that sermon. So he's kind of making fun of Southern Christians who were enabling slavery. This is one of the audiences that he is unsparing towards in his criticism, in his autobiography. So Blight writes, rooted in memories of watching Thomas Auld weep, that was one of his masters, during his confessions in the ring at the Methodist camp meeting on the Eastern Shore, in Edward Covey's prayer sessions, that's a man that was charged with breaking Douglass as a slave, Edward Covey's prayer sessions, and in his New Bedford preaching experience, Douglass saved his best for the Christian hypocrisy of the South. If he spoke in a church or hall with a gallery, he made special use of the setting, as he did in 1842 in Faneuil Hall in Boston. Peering up into the horseshoe balcony of that great arena, before 4,000 people, and spreading his arms out widely, he appealed as though to the slaves set apart in the gallery of a southern church. With a mocking southern accent, he called out, "And you too, my friends, have souls of infinite value, souls that will live through endless happiness or misery in eternity. Oh, labor diligently to make your calling and election sure. Oh, receive into your souls these words of the holy apostle, servants, be obedient to your masters." Amid shouts of laughter and applause, Douglas pranced on the stage and drove his point home. "Oh, consider the wonderful goodness of God. Look at your hard, horny hands, your strong, muscular frames, and see how mercifully he has adapted you to the duties you are to fulfill. While to your masters, who have slender frames and long, delicate fingers, he has given brilliant intellects that they may do the thinking while you do the working."
Ooh.
That's a little spicy.
It is, yeah. So he was critical of those Southern Christians, and there's interesting anecdotes throughout his autobiography about what they would do.
Well, I got sick last week and had to miss 2 days of class, and so I have not gotten a lot of reading done. I did start the Deacon's Book by the Nine Marks series by Matt Smethurst. I'm in deacon training at my church, and so we're going to go through this and a couple of other books, and so that's pretty good. The only other noteworthy thing is on my drives into work, sometimes I'll pull up a YouTube video and I'll have it going and listening to it, and I've been listening to the Trump interview by Joe Rogan. Have you guys watched it? It's profanity-laced, but it's super eye-opening. And so I'm not going to recommend it, but I want to recommend it.
Was it recent? Like when?
Yeah. Well, it's just the one that he had before he got elected with Joe Rogan. Yeah. I only seen clips of it, but it just strikes me that, you know, Joe Rogan was such a liberal for so long,
right?
But he, there's something about him that values truth to a level. And because the left was so abusing truth and lying so much, Rogan's like, this is stupid. It's very interesting. It's like two regular guys talking about like all the problems. And yet I, the worldview wise, I'm not going to line up with either on a big level, but when it comes to like talking truthfully about like, hey, that's wasteful. Hey, that it was refreshing in some ways.
Yeah. It's interesting because Rogan used to live in California, and yeah, I think he really comes to terms with democratic liberal ideology as he's trying to be a citizen in California. He now lives in
Austin, Texas.
But it's also interesting, not to date us, but I think Elon Musk has had similar interactions where, like, yes, if you want to go down the wormhole of like one of his children and like a transition.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And just like kind of him. I don't think Elon has ever really been in the camp as well, but there's, in real ways, they've interacted with the practical side mm-hmm. of an ideology and realized that this is wanting.
Yep.
And it's, I don't think either one of them really are grabbing power, but I think they're trying to help avoid the practical outworking of an inferior
mm-hmm.
ideology.
Wisdom. But, calls out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the levels of waste they're uncovering is, that's probably a whole episode, but we got questions to answer.
Anyway. So yeah, we've got a list of questions. Some of these are from emails. Some of these are from Christian experience students of Andy and I.
That's right.
And we both ask students to submit questions, and this is a fun way of answering them. So we're going to go through. I noticed that Andy had typed out some thoughts on the first one. So do you want to start with the first one?
Yep. So this one's a listener email. So Ellie Saylor, shout out to Ellie. She asked this. She says, the subject of Christians in sports, she says, is it helpful or edifying to participate in them? We have been served this idea from the world that sports build character. But if that is true, then why do we see such a lack of morality in so many top athletes? I know our school faith competes in and promotes sports, so I'm definitely not trying to be divisive or assertive or assert one view is better. I'm just truly wanting to desire an objective answer that can be traced biblically so I can better think through it. Good question. When I think about sports builds character, and then you look at the athletes and you wonder if that's true. There was a guy who was trying to justify God and evil, and he said, well, the reason that evil exists is to build character. And so when you go through difficulty, it builds your character. And this is not like a Christian answer. This is like a non-Christian. And so all you have to do is look at any dirty old man, you know, they've been around a long time. They've gone through a lot of difficulty, and yet they're kind of creepy old man. So that is an interesting reductio ad absurdum, Ellie. Well done. Well done. So what do you guys think? You have any thoughts?
I mean, with my children, we play basketball and we'll do things every once in a while. And one of the reasons is because they get taken advantage of, or what, they lose. And then that's a trial that God sovereignly brings into their life. And then what does it reveal? It reveals their heart. So I do believe that there is a value at that level, or there can be, as a dad, that I can then use to disciple my children, to help expose heart desires. And sports has a way of really accentuating or making it apparent. So I do see that there can be some value. The problem is, I mean, how much sports do you have to play to expose that, or to learn that discipline?
Yeah.
Okay. You don't have to play a whole lot to grow through that side of sports playing. And so then, you know, when you're starting to invest so much time and energy into these greater athletic endeavors, well, then what's really the motivation behind all of that? I generally find that it's not the most Christian of virtues.
Well, I would say, as one who was involved in athletics all year round from the age of probably 10 all the way up through into college — I didn't play athletics in college because I wanted to do other things with my life at that point — that there are things that were valuable about it. It does teach you how to do hard things, and there's different kinds of character, so you have to keep that in mind as well. But some of the things that I would maybe caution Christian parents about, particularly in our day and age, it's very quickly and clearly becoming the god of American culture, much like football or soccer is the god of European culture. And so here in Ankeny, for example, when we're driving to church every Sunday morning in the spring, you see hundreds of kids between the ages of 6 and 16 on the soccer field or on the baseball field on Sunday morning, and that is their worship. The other thing I would say is, as somebody who was educated in public school, and so the athletic teams I was on were public school kids, on the one hand, you have a great platform as a Christian in those settings to be a witness and a testimony. My sister was that way. She was an excellent testimony with her teammates, a witness, but I was immature and I lacked wisdom, and so I was more quickly swept along with the public school kind of environment than I was being a witness or a testimony. That's one thing. And the other thing is, traveling with those guys, there are things that I heard and things that I saw that I cannot unhear and that I cannot unsee now as a 40-year-old man. And so there's just a lot of negatives that might outweigh the positives in some ways.
Yeah. And I went to public school as well. I won't add anything to the conversation. There is value to be had there. You can be a platform. I would just, if you want to find a resource, there, I think CJ Mahaney has a very small book/pamphlet called Use Your Sports. But I would just, you know, same cautions that Josh brought, is that you're, especially from a parent looking at a child, I think a parent is sometimes living vicariously through their children, pushing a child into an arena, wanting success, and somehow drawing a high off of that. It's an idolatry of watching your kid succeed. But there is a value there that can be a means of relationship between a parent and a child. But I would strongly caution the company that the child keeps in athletics, that when you start talking about competition and success and winning, usually the people that get drawn or attracted to that, you know, why do we see high caliber athletes with really poor lives? Well, the nature of the job, the nature of the activity is drawing pride And once they've ascended, then, you know, they are the god and they can do whatever they want. And so you'd really want to protect a child from that.
And I played baseball until I was in eighth grade, starting when I was six. We made it to nationals and AAU and stuff like that. And I would agree with everything you've said. And you've said, my first exposure to porn came through baseball friends. And it was like, I can't go back and fix that. Mm-hmm. And then also it's, I would say that there's something physically good. I remember, Tim Challies had a post where he said he's getting to the age where he has to go to the gym now to keep himself healthy. And it was like, hey, this is important. And so it reminds me of 1 Timothy 4:8, where in verse 7, Paul says, have nothing to do with irreverent, silly myths. Rather, train yourselves for godliness. For while bodily training is of some value, godliness is value in every way, as it holds promise for the present life and also for the life to come. So I do think you can steward your sports, and they can teach you lessons, and you can be physically healthy to serve the Lord longer. We've all known ministers who have made a big difference in a life, and then they had to stop early because of health stuff. Yep. But I would say that, like, you know, would you say that sports is ministry? I don't know if I'd say that. I'd say you could minister in your sport, you know, in the same way I wouldn't. Is CCM something ministry? I don't know. Yeah. Like, ministry is discipling and following the Lord. Ministry is local church. Ministry is like life on life. And so maybe it could happen, but I don't think you need sports to do that. But yeah, good question.
Great question, Ellie. And we'll move on to number two here. What is the best way to protect our purity as young Christians against sexual immorality? I think this is one of my students. How can someone overcome the struggle if they fall into it? So I just put down three quick bullets here. So, you know, it took me about 10 seconds to write out three bullets. So if I needed to write five bullets, you know, maybe 15 seconds could prove I can do something valuable. Number one, seek awareness of your loves. So how does someone protect purity? You have to be aware of what's drawing you and enticing you. So what do you love? What passions are seeking to control you? You should seek accountability. So number two, like, if you want to guard yourself from this, you should have people in your life that ask you difficult questions, that can have difficult conversations with you, where you can be honest and open with them. If you're a child, your parents should serve this function. Pastors, other godly men and women in your church, but you should seek accountability. And then you do need to seek replacement. So if you have a habit that you're pursuing, passion, Andy, I think a week or two ago just talked about, you have to turn and pursue godliness. Mm-hmm. So that it's not just flee the youthful lust, but you have to pursue the right thing. So those are my three bullets there. Seek awareness of loves, seek accountability, and seek replacement. But what do you guys think?
I'm not going to add much. A lot of young people struggle with purity, but then they don't see the worldly intake that they have all the time. I'm like, so I'm just echoing what Charlie is saying here. You know, you need to think through all of the entertainment sources that you might even deem wholesome, or at least they're not wicked. Okay, but maybe they're not wicked, but they're still, are they wholesome? Are they drawing you to God? And I would contend the answer is probably not. So pursue actual wholesome living, which usually doesn't have to do with the screen.
And just to if you want to go further down that road, we have a previous episode on Pursuing Godliness Part 2. I just listened through that on one of my drives, and it's literally going to answer this question. But the big thing is what you said. It's what you love, and where you're like, there are so many times where I'm avoiding the big bad things, but like, I'm filling my mind with, you know, lesser things.
Really quickly, I would just say about the accountability piece, and I don't know if this is in Heath Lambert's book, Finally Free, or if I read it somewhere else, but it's really important that you, if you're a young man, for example, that you find an older man who has wisdom rather than a friend who's also struggling. And just be very open and honest, and have other people in your life that know about this. Confess your sins to one another, and that will be really, really helpful.
All right. Our next question. Why is drinking any amount of alcohol typically looked down on in Christian circles if Jesus drank wine?
So we'll answer that one. But there is one that is highlighted green at the top of the page.
Okay. So I read the wrong question.
That's okay. Let's talk about the alcohol.
So you're the person to talk to about alcohol.
So we had a couple of episodes on the podcast, episodes 134 and 135, and you really need to go and listen to those episodes for an answer. If I try to answer anything here quickly, it's just going to seem very trite and unpersuasive. So I will just say, like, I've translated Aristotle, I've interacted with Greek history, I've studied the Hebrew words, shachar, yayin, tirosh, okay? I've worked through a lot of those studies. I'm not trying to boast here, I'm trying to tell you, I've studied this significantly, and I worked through that on episodes 134, and we did it on 134 and 135. And what you're going to find is that those words for wine do not correspond to what you would go and purchase at a grocery store. The substance is different. And now you're like, wait a minute, that just sounds all messed up. I know. And I probably sound like an idiot to you too. Okay. That's why you need to go and listen to episodes 134 and 135. And what you're going to see is that there's a difference. I don't have a problem drinking kombucha. All right. That has some alcohol in it. So, yeah.
The level of alcohol is so minuscule, by the way. Just listener, if you're like, what? It's like 0.005 or something. The other thing to say is that Keith Kobelia, who's professor in the Bible department, he did a chapel sermon about 3 weeks ago, and he approached the exact same question you did, went a totally different route, and came to the exact same conclusion you did, Tim. Yep. And so he compares alcohol content levels. There's a history of how you brew. And what we have today, his point is that the alcohol we drink today is actually infused with extra. It's not brewed to that level. You may have mentioned that, but Keith really went down the rabbit hole on the science of it. And so it would not have been possible to create what we have today in the Bible time. It would have been very unlikely. The situation and the setting and the conditions would have had to been just...
It's a false analogy to say their wine and what they're saying about wine corresponds to what you find in the... Yeah. On the shelf today.
And if that's even possible, you should really look into it before you engage in drinking, because you might be walking against what the Bible says and thinking the Bible justifies it.
And I'll just throw in, I'm not going to talk about really the alcohol argument at all, but I just want to bring in a consideration that there are people in every one of our churches that have struggled with alcohol. And let's assume, I will give the benefit of the doubt, that let's assume that drinking alcohol is the stronger brother position and that it is okay. You should yield to the vices of your weaker brother and understand that if you tell that person in your church, or practically you live a life that tells the addict that what they're doing is okay, you will put a stumbling block in front of somebody. And I know people in both of the churches I've served in that would be devastated if you'd say, hey, oh no, there's nothing wrong with this. And you give them the license, and obviously you're not culpable for another person's sin ever, but read in 1 Corinthians, read in Romans 14 and 15, even if that, and I would agree with Tim that I think there's a strong exegetical biblical argument against drinking alcohol today. But even if I will cede to you the stronger brother argument, you have a responsibility to not put a stumbling block in front of your brothers and sisters in Christ. And if you can't take that admonition, that command in Romans and 1 Corinthians seriously, it has nothing to do with alcohol. You need to study how you ought to interact with other Christians. Now, that would be my admonition there.
And then consider that meat is what Paul's talking about. And meat is way more necessary to live than like a beer. Like, we've got all kinds of other drinks. We don't need that. You need water. But Paul was willing to give up like a staple. Like, I know not everyone has much meat, but still.
There's a really, I don't know if it's even recorded, but Dr. Paul walked through in 1 Corinthians, the weaker, stronger brother stuff a few years ago at Refresh. And there's the passage, you know, to the Greek, I became like a Greek, or to the Gentile, I became like a Gentile, to the Jew, I became like a Jew. When he gets to the section of weak, it doesn't say I became like weak. It says I became weak. And Dr. Paul highlighted that. It's like, so if you have an issue here, meat, I'm not just going to pay lip service to it and kind of consent and, you know, kind of do the bare minimum. It's like, no, I'm going to become that. I'm going to become the weaker brother out of service to them. So if we bring that into the arena of the alcohol discussion, I think there's a strong case that even if it is okay, out of love for your brother, you should give it up. And what does Paul say? If eating meat causes my brother to stumble, I will never again eat meat. And you should at least be willing to do that with not just drinking, but any issue in the Christian life that would cause a brother to stumble. But it's, you know, we're oversimplifying, you know, using a lot of generalities. I would, again, just go listen to those episodes. I think they'll be helpful.
All right. Our next question. As Christians, do we believe something or a place can be haunted? How would we define haunted? Should we avoid places that are haunted? And how would we determine if something were to be haunted?
Pretty sure I saw Dr. Myron the other day. No. Now, I make that joke because if Myron was here, he would make that joke.
Any thoughts?
I've literally never thought of this question. Like, I saw it, I thought, I don't even know.
What is haunting connected to? Go ahead. What do you think?
Well, let me, go ahead. Can I insert something else?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think this question, I've thought of it before and I thought, that's a bunch of nonsense. But my neighbor across the street years ago used to watch those ghost hunter shows where they would go into haunted houses and with spectral, like weird stuff. And she really believed that she had a VCR. No, it was a DVD player upstairs. And most nights at like 2:12 in the morning, it would do something. And she thought it was her mom saying it'll be okay, because her mom always liked to watch videos. And I remember thinking, I didn't know how to respond. And I was trying to share the gospel with her, and I didn't know if that was the thing to talk about. But later I remember thinking, that's an automatic update trying to go every night or something. Like, that's all this is. Like, it turns on, does an automatic update, and it turns off. And you're interpreting it to be this, like, my mom is still here or something. So I think what I realize is it's relevant and I need to think it out. I have not thought. I mean, if there is haunting, it's, I would think, demons or something like negative, something spiritually bad.
So looking at it through a biblical worldview, we agree that angels and demons exist. We also agree that they can be earthbound, that they can be here. They can, take a form of human. And we also know biblically that people can be possessed. And so there's even accounts in the Gospels where, like, you know, where does the demoniac live? In the tombs, you know? So, like, there is a connection on a human level with demonic, spiritual activity and, you know, certain places. The bare fact is that there isn't scriptural evidence to say that something can or cannot be haunted, as in, like, a house. I think the idea would be like, oh, the house is haunted. Why? Because there's a demon there. So in that sense, that we would agree that there could be demons on earth, of course a place could be, using that definition of haunted, it could be haunted. Should we avoid places that are haunted, and how would we determine if something were to be haunted? Well, clearly you should probably avoid, what would be meritorious of seeking out whether something is haunted and then dwelling in that place, if it were to be? I can't come up with a valid reason.
You know, thinking about it, there's my mind just went blank. I had the thought. So in the scripture, there's the demoniac, there's the haunted people or whatever, and Jesus casts them out. But then in 1 Corinthians, that meat sacrificed idols thing, Paul says, like, an idol's nothing. It's not anything. So I wonder if we could also say, like, a haunted location in that same sense is not anything. And so even if there's a demon there, like greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. So you could maybe have sort of that sort of a thing too, that,
yeah,
because I think there's the real demon activity that you're talking about. But in our culture today, like, we really hold up Halloween and dark things and horror movies. And so then you get scared and you're like thinking of those things all over the place. And then you got the charismatic movement and all their angel and demonology. So it could be two things. It could be one thing where there's, like what you said, a real demon presence. And it could just be, mm-hmm, you've watched too many cartoons and movies. You need to, like, get rid of that stuff.
Yeah. And in general,
I probably need to do more study on this.
If you have a strong appetite for cult-like entertainment, you know, zombies, vampires, you know, demons, like horror movie, like that might be a bigger revealer to you of a personal appetite than, you know, like, what should I or should I not go to a haunted house? You know, like, I don't know if I'll take a strong position on that, but if that is what is driving you, like, oh, I just love this stuff, like, you might want to consider, why do you love that? You know, even if we're playing like the good, better, best game, like, even if that's the good option, what's the better or the best option here? So
I understand that we as Christians have no need to fear,
yes,
any of this. Yep. So just be clear on that point. And what these men are saying is really helpful too. Okay. Why, or who cares? Like, you know, just why would you ever invite or participate in or desire or any of that? So there's that side of things. And then there's, oh, you happen to be in a place that's presumably haunted, but I don't care. We have nothing to fear because all authority has been given to Christ.
Next question. If the high priest wore some kind of hat in the Holy of Holies, why is it, quote, wrong, quote, to wear one in church? And I would say, because the church is not the Holy of Holies. Okay, so first of all, the Holy of Holies had the presence of God, and if you went in the wrong way, you're going to get whacked. Like, you're going to die. If I go into a church gathering and I have sin, that's actually okay. In fact, part of the gathering is I should recognize that and repent, you know, in the ministry of the word. So I would say the two things aren't the same. And so I think that's a false equivalency. And if that's what you're going for, I think you need to be a little more careful about how you think of two things together.
And I don't remember. I think this is one of the Christian Experience students. I'm just going to peel back a layer here. I think the real question that's being asked is it wrong to wear hats to church?
Yes, exactly.
And you can see my bullet point. Is it wrong to wear a hat to church? I would, you know, I think there's a cultural, mm-hmm, remnant of some things here. And so, Tim, you want to comment there?
I've got like a website that just kind of is like about hat etiquette. And it's different for men and women, but hats can be left on, according to this rando website, outdoors, at athletic events, indoors or out, on public transportation, in public buildings, such as post office, airports, hotels, so on and so forth, on elevators. But you're supposed to take your hat off in somebody's house, at mealtimes, at the table, while being introduced indoors or out, in a house of worship. Okay, so it's basically a cultural construct that we have in our society, and it's a matter of respect. So you take your hat off as a matter of respect, a man does, in these certain settings. So this isn't a like rule or whatever that's for all times and everywhere. It's more of just what our culture deems as respectful. So I think it's something that is plausible and something that we should abide by, just because that's our culture's definition of respect. One last, mm-hmm, thing though, a Jewish person, they do wear a hat. They wear a kippah because they see it as, I'm not worthy to come close to God. And so there's like this barrier between them. It's a matter of humility to wear the kippah. So there are different cultural appropriations to the idea of hat wearing. So you need to interpret that discussion in light of your culture.
And some people are going to hear that answer and say, then it's all just subjective. Who cares? I'm just doing this because other people want me to. But I think you brought up this earlier. You'll stand up and take your hat off when you're saying the Pledge of Allegiance or the flag's flying. There's all kinds of areas in your life already that you demonstrate decorum. And so I think it's probably good just to go with the culture. Now, what if the culture said decorum is to like give the middle finger to, you know, whatever, like something obscene? Well, of course we're not going to do that. And then I don't know if we really want to get into the head covering issue in Corinthians. Okay, let's not do that yet. Okay. So, but I would say that the other day, we had a casual day on campus, and so students were wearing hats, but there is a rule in the student handbook, no hats in buildings, which I think is just to train them like, hey, this is what it's going to be like out there. And so, you know, that issue did come up.
All right. Our next question here. If I sometimes doubt the Bible and the existence of God, does this make me an unbeliever? So that's a very wide-angled question. And so I put a bullet there. If you read through the Gospels, there are disciples that are doubting Jesus after they've seen him resurrected. So you ought to ponder that. I think there are some chapel messages from Dr. Jeff Newman where he talks about that exact facet of discipleship. Like, how do we work through doubts? And so that will be helpful to you. But any other thoughts?
I would tweak the question to demonstrate something. So the question is this: if I sometimes doubt the Bible and the existence of God, does that make me an unbeliever? So let's flip that. If I sometimes wonder if the Bible is true and God exists, does that make me, the atheist, a believer? Like, you can have questions about your current position and it doesn't make you that other thing. There's like a level of commitment involved. So the other day I was talking to a student who was talking about some doubts. And I think in the midst of doubts, if you're not certain, what is the way you demonstrate your faith? You continue to walk with the Lord and pursue his means of grace. I would say that's maybe part of it. Also, for me, when I look at my life, when I experienced the worst doubts, I often had some levels of sin, not always, but sometimes. So you may want to consider, are you opening yourself up about your sin to other people?
I would simply add a passage that comes to my mind regularly, and I forget if it's in Mark 7 or Mark 9, but the man that says, Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Kind of a prayer that I have said occasionally myself is, Lord, I believe. And it's what you said, Tim, going back to the things that we know to be true, rehearsing the gospel to ourselves, but then praying and saying, help my unbelief. Help me understand more than I currently do.
So our next question, what does the Bible teach about free will? How do I reconcile this with the doctrine of irresistible grace?
Okay, so I have some big quotes here that I just want to blast through. So this is, if you want to read about this, there's almost every systematic theology book in the history of man is going to pontificate on this question. We will not solve this problem for you. Talk about doubts, you know, like skepticism. You start trying to rationalize seemingly contradictory ideas theologically, and you can kind of find yourself out of sorts. Here are some quotes. This is from Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology, page 700. Sometimes the term irresistible grace is used in this connection. It refers to the fact that God effectively calls people and also gives them regeneration, and both actions guarantee that we will respond in saving faith. The term irresistible grace is subject to misunderstanding, however, since it seems to imply that people do not make a voluntary, willing choice in responding to the gospel. There's our conflict. Sovereignty of God in saving people, his irresistible grace. Well, then how is the person choosing to believe? There's our tension. Grudem is saying this can be misunderstood, that they're not making a voluntary, willing choice in responding to the gospel, a wrong idea and a wrong misunderstanding of the term irresistible grace. The term does preserve something valuable, however, because it indicates that God's work reaches into our hearts to bring about a response that is absolutely certain, even though we respond voluntarily. So Grudem gives an answer to that, saying, you could be misunderstanding what the term means, irresistible grace. That does not mean that someone's not making a willful choice. Continuing, this is Grudem talking about the providence of God, so in the sovereignty side of the equation. This is Grudem 330. Thus, when we ask whether we have a, quote, free will, it is important to be clear as to what is meant by the phrase. Scripture nowhere says that we are, quote, free in the sense of being outside of God's control or being able to make decisions that are not caused by anything. Parenthesis, this is the sense in which many people seem to assume we must be free. Nor does it say we are, quote, free in the sense of being able to do right on our own apart from God's power.
Yeah, that is really good, like those last couple sentences.
But we are nonetheless free in the greatest sense that any creature of God could be free. We make willing choices, choices that have real effects. We are aware of no restraints on our will from God when we make decisions. We must insist that we have the power of willing choice. Otherwise, we will fall into the air of fatalism or determinism, and thus conclude that our choices do not matter or that we cannot really make willing choices. On the other hand, the kind of freedom that is demanded by those who deny God's, I think that's providential control of all things. I voiced a texted this quote, so there's some typos. Those who deny God's providential control of all things, a freedom to be outside of God, sustaining and controlling activity would be impossible. If Jesus Christ is indeed continually carrying along things by his word or power, if this is true, then to be outside of that providential control would simply not to exist. So God is in control. He's sustaining the whole universe. If our freedom means that we're outside of that providential care, the only way to truly be free would not be in existence. So I found those passages from Grudem's Systematic Theology very good. Here's a helpful quote from Ryrie that I think you should always consider when you start discussing free will and the sovereignty of God. No human mind will ever harmonize sovereignty and free will, but ignoring or downplaying one or the other in the interest of a supposed harmony will solve nothing. So ultimately, he's like, hey, you're human. You can't really understand this fully. There's many things we don't know. There's a mystery to theology, and this is one of the most mysterious things. You should be careful not to hit either ditch. The Bible does clearly teach that both of these things stand true. So any other thoughts there?
That's really good. The part of the Ryrie quote that I like the most is that no human mind will ever harmonize. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these kinds of questions in my life have calmed way down, and I'm not as concerned anymore, but it's partly because I recognize I'm created and I don't own myself. And if he hasn't made it clear, I don't have to make it up. And I think it's not that I don't study it. I do. But then if there's a tension, I'm okay with that. And he doesn't owe me any answer to that. Because usually when these things come up, it's like, well, then if I sin, is it really it's like you're just passing blame to God.
Mm-hmm. And there, the second of those Grudem quotes, there is like a 12-page discourse on the providence of God, different subcategories, and thinking that through. And again, any systematic theology that you pull off the shelf is going to try and walk this through. And, you know, you do want to read and think. You could go right back to Calvin, but it's not a problem that has a very nice clean cut answer. All right. And we're kind of getting to the end of an hour here. So we have a couple questions left. This is going to be speed round answers. So
this will be fun.
All right. So we did have a couple of questions related to prayer. So
dude, you could be an auctioneer.
Speed round. How often do you pray? What are some simple steps to improve for your prayer life? And then another question about prayer, or several questions about prayer. How to pray conversationally, on knees, lying down, who to pray to, Father only, can you pray directly to Jesus, the Spirit too, ?
I think the first one's easy. How often do you pray? The verse in Thessalonians says to pray without ceasing. I don't think that means you have to always pray constantly all day long. But especially when you look at how Paul prayed, he prayed often. If you look at how Jesus prayed, he prayed often and he prayed lengthy. So I think if we look at Paul and Jesus as our examples, then we would say we want to pray regularly. How to pray, one thing, and like, or how to improve your prayer life. I found studying the Lord's Prayer as an emblematic prayer, or like the way to pray, was helpful. So he starts off with, our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name. So you're honoring the Lord. You're praising his name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. You submit to his will and ask for his will to be accomplished. When I started praying that regularly in 2015, 2016, I was surprised how often I was doing good things, but I wasn't considering if that was God's will. and it directed me away. So you can just follow that out. That'd be one thought.
Speed round. How do you improve your prayer life? Schedule it, and then I'll challenge you before you pray, write out what you're going to pray. Those two things will improve it.
There are some Puritan books that can help you pray more substantively. One would be A Way to Pray by Matthew Henry, and another is The Valley of Vision. So if you're trying to just do what some of these men are talking about, these are model prayers, and they're basically praying scripture. So I would recommend them. And then I would make a distinction between different kinds of prayer. Sometimes you're just praying, and it's just like you're walking around, or you're driving the car, or you're whatever, and you can pray, and I do that. But then there's a different kind of intercessory prayer, where even on Saturday, I was with another dad, and we got down on our knees, we lifted up our hands, and we prayed more earnestly. And so you can do these things, and I'm going to have a future episode about raising hands, which will intersect with that side of the conversation as well.
I would simply add, be intentional. So having a list of people to pray for, things to pray for, associating certain days of the week with people that you pray for. So for example, Thursday morning is a good time to pray for your church family because you've just had prayer meeting on Wednesday night and you have a lot of requests. Saturday mornings are a good time, or Sunday mornings are a good time to pray for your friends who are pastors because they'll be standing in the pulpit to preach the next morning.
That's good. D.A. Carson, in his book, Spiritual Reformation, or A Call to Spiritual Reformation, he talks about Paul's prayers, but he also talks about his method of praying, and he does the, like, near to you, or no, Piper does near to you, far to you, and then Carson had a very similar setup to you. So, all right, next question in the speed round. How do I focus on others rather than myself and my own feelings? Thoughts?
So I wrote a comment there. So you need to align goals to reality. So if you were to say, I'm not going to think about myself at all, I'm going to think about everyone else completely, is that a realistic goal? No, it is not. And you can make a general sweeping declaration, I'm not going to think about myself anymore, and then you could just burn yourself. So I would say, think about goals like king size versus snack size. You grow in baby steps. I would look for very simple, small ways that you can schedule and build into your life. Okay, I'm going to think about this other person. And you're not going to just snap your fingers and wake up and have all of the ills gone and have all of the good there. So I would try to have simple, small snack size goals. You're not buying the king size candy bar, you know, just very simple ones.
One basic thing would be to observe them. Like, what are they wearing? What do they look like? What do they sound like? Do they look tired? Do they look like spend time becoming a people watcher? Yeah. That naturally makes you focus on other people. And some people are just so focused on themselves, they miss what's right in front of them.
And I would connect this one to your prayer life. If you're praying for people, then that's going to help your focus as well.
All right. Last question. You can see my fun retort. Can we be friends with Christians who are continually rebelling? And what my thought went to here was, can I go to the bathroom? I don't know. Can you?
You're horrendous.
So, can you be friends with someone who's rebelling? Yeah, you can.
Jesus was a friend of sinners.
Yeah. I think the heart of the question is, should we?
And there's different kinds of rebelling. Jesus is a friend of sinners. Okay, yes. But then there's the people who have rejected the faith and they're moving away from it. They've deconstructed and they know what the truth is and they're saying no to the truth. Yeah. And those are the people, what you're going to find is that you're going to have a difficult time being their friend. You have nothing to talk about. This has been my experience, and you can only talk about the weather or sports teams or whatever for so long, and then you're just naturally going on a different path.
I would say that it comes down to one thing, and I'll give one piece of advice. It depends on the level of influence they have in your life. If they influence you, and if they pull you in the wrong direction, you shouldn't. And you would say, Andy, what about their soul? What about sharing the gospel with them? Where do you make that argument? Go to the book of Proverbs. It warns you against the fool, and you don't want to become foolish. And part of it is to stay away and find wisdom. So I would say, if you're not mature, that's going to be really challenging. If you're mature in your walk with the Lord, it's going to be less challenging.
And if you are mature, you're not going to want to hang out with them.
What?
And then if they're a scoffer, you shouldn't enjoy their company. There's something that should be driving you apart. Go ahead.
I had a friend who they would hang out with this person from their church. And it's interesting, like if you saw both these people, you'd think, oh, they're godly people. But my friend would hang out with this other person at church. And that other person, whenever they would hang out together, would be making comments about other people at church and then laughing at people's like shortcomings. And it was just an uncomfortable thing. And it was like, I don't prefer that. And so it's never developed anything.
All right. Thank you guys to our students and the people who emailed questions in. Thank you for sending those to us. And we hope that the answers are helpful. As always, if you have other questions you'd like us to interact with, you can email us at thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. And we hope you have a great rest of your day and week. And we'll see you next week on another episode of the Thinklings Podcast. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.